I find it interesting that Ford and her floozy are absent.
It's a conspiracy.
Agile is clearly very agitated indeed.
She's been studying us for the entire voyage. She's going to have her minions chip and file us. We're being press-ganged.
At which precise moment, Granita storms into the saloon. Two Arbiters trail behind, desperately battling to finish dressing her.
What is this disturbance about?
She demands.
Attention! You will comply with all instructions on pain of immediate arrest. We are coming aboard now.
I look away from my stealth feed. Above me, beyond the blue nimbus of the drive field, I see a slim black knife shape. Painfully bright lights flash on and off along its flanks as it maneuvers toward the Pygmalion. Lightning plays across the glowing magsail ceiling. The intruder's exhaust stream is doing strange things to the plasma bubble.
Hey, do you see that?
I stitched a patch cable into the neck of my sack of troublesome assistants just in case I needed their withering sarcasm for a change. Now it seems like a good thing I took the precaution.
Do we need to think about moving?
Yep.
I can't tell whether it's Bill or Ben, but he doesn't sound happy.
Looks like a VAS IMR and high thrust. They can't hold it for long. But if they don't dock quickly, it'll short out the plasma bubble. Look down.
I take his advice, and I wish I hadn't. The blue nowhere beneath my feet is rippling and shimmering like an ocean surface before a storm front. Pinpricks stipple it like rust.
That's not good, is it?
I think it's going to be all right,
says Ben, or Bill, the other one anyway.
They're on final approach. Won't be long now.
Look at it move. That's military thrust, all right.
I look back at the approaching intruder. Pirates? Or police? I'm not sure it really matters at this point. Neither of them would be good news. The ship is slim and smooth-edged, with triangular tiled surfaces that make my eyes hurt as I try to trace its outline. The stubby cone of its main drive is just visible now, the bell nozzle glowing violet-hot even through the hazy plasma overcast. It sideslips toward Pygmalion, and for almost a minute I'm frozen with fear, terrified that it's going to ram the ship we dangle from, or quench the ionized bubble, or angle its main engine just wrong and blast us all to white-hot shrapnel with its plasma rocket. Then the glare vanishes, and there's a ripple in the cable that tells me the two ships have locked together above us. And part of me realizes, of course, they don't want to destabilize the sail. Not with us riding the Phobos magbeam on final approach.
It's time for Stage C, says Bill, or Ben, presumably reading off Pygmalion's detailed checklist.
Is it?
I check the other bag dangling from my belt. Yes, it's the one we made up earlier.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's keep an eye on what's going on in the saloon, yes?
I start the ascent, climbing hand over hand and reeling in the cable as I go. I feel like I only weigh about a kilogram here, even with my passengers. The trick is going to be not overdoing things and ramming the underside of the airlock head first. The air in the saloon is steaming. The passengers are engaged in furious recriminations. Granita is tearing a strip off the Lyrie twins. Reza Agile is demanding my head. She appears to think I'm a police spy, of all things. And Mary X is huddled in a corner, desperately trying to convince anyone who'll listen to her that she's nothing to do with whatever is happening. Meanwhile, the steam is thickening, pumping into the saloon in great gouts. Pygmalion has fallen silent, evidently succumbing to whatever pressure our assailants can bring to bear on a spaceship over a direct docking link. I can't tell precisely what's happening, but I'm sure of one thing. The best place to be when your spaceship is being boarded by bad bots who are looking for you is on board another vessel. A rasping voice of authority comes over the broadcast channel again.
Attention, passengers and ship. Your pressurized compartments are being fumigated. Police agents will come aboard once fumigation is complete. This is an official replication suppression agency inspection. You are suspected of harboring illegal replicators. You will be inspected and sterilized before you are allowed to proceed to Marsport. Resistance will be punished severely.
It is the Pink Police. Of all my luck. Pirates would actually be preferable. You can usually negotiate a ransom with extra-legal capitalists. But the Pink Police are distressingly short of venality. I pause, pressing a hand against the base of my abdomen. I can see the payload inside me with my mind's eye, restlessly replicating. Do magnetic fields damage pink goo, I suddenly wonder. I could have blown the mission completely. But I don't have time to worry about that now, if I'm going to save myself. On the other hand, I think, as I close in on the docking tunnel above me, the last place they're going to look for it is aboard their own ship. Right? Gouts of high-temperature water vapor blister the delicate paintwork of the Pygmalion saloon, soak into the colorful nylon and polyester padding, and steam up the senses. There is some complaining and grumbling from the passengers, but the announcement that it's an official RSA inspection damps down the state of near panic. Nobody likes the Pink Police, but the prevailing state of public opinion is that they fulfill a nasty but necessary requirement. And so the reaction is muted and the atmosphere steamy when the police jet in. I don't know what I was expecting of the Pink Police, but this isn't it. They're using drones, basketball-sized metal spheres studded with thrusters and sensors. What? No villainous cops swarming aboard with DNA scanners clenched between their teeth? Two spheres, three. They spin around with unreal grace, bouncing between floor and walls and ceiling, pointing their sensors everywhere. The steam gouting through the companionway obscures my view of them, but I can see the passengers cringing. Then,
"Hello? Big Slow? You can let us out now. Remember us?"
It's Bill, or Ben, in the bag at my waist. With a start, I notice that the sky outside my eye slit has turned black, the ghostly blue haze stretching away to an indefinite horizon beneath my trailing feet. The boarding tube looms just overhead, a violent tentacle thrusting into the unwilling Pygmalion's airlock. "Right." I loosen the flap holding them in, and Bill, or Ben, pops a prehensile, beady-eyed head out and looks around. Then he grabs hold of my face and swarms up to the cable, followed closely by his sib, along with the bag. I'm not used to being used as a stepladder.
"Hey!" "Keep it low, Big Slow. We're trying to be sneaky. You want to get ready to mate with the decoy?"
"If you think it's time." I tie the other bag to the line, then open and start preparing its contents. There's a suit of clothes that the Honorable Kate Sorico never really liked, and a bunch of stuff to fill it out. Bulky stuff, massive. And padded with feedstock from the room printer that Pygmalion swore blind would look like a body on radar.
"Nearly there, Big Slow. Get ready."
What we're about to try is really stupid, but it beats all of the alternatives we've come up with. I check the parasitic feed, but all it shows me is billowing steam. Someone, I think it may be Mary X, is complaining about the humidity wrecking her hairdo. The plan is simple, if not simple-minded. A, send out a bunch of encrypted decoy messages addressed to Jeeves, purely by way of distraction. Done. B, get out of Pygmalion before the police come storming aboard and stay out of sight. Done. So far. C, let them search the ship. D, dump a decoy, so they go herring off after it. E, reboard Pygmalion and hope they conclude that we left earlier, or were never there in the first place. or that they need to conserve fuel for their own orbital injection, or something. Like I said, it's completely stupid. It's just that, as Pygmalion pointed out, it stands a faint chance of keeping us out of the hands of the Pink Police, unlike any of the alternatives on offer. Ready. It's best not to think too hard about the holes in this plan, even though I can see plenty. Really, short of sitting there and waiting for them to arrest us, there's not anything else we can do. And who knows? Maybe it'll even work.
Okay, Big. Give it some elbow.
I draw my legs up and shove the decoy hard in the small of her well-padded back. She floats away at a good clip, picking up speed rapidly and falling through the flickering blue curtain in only a few seconds. She's got to cross another few kilometers of nearly empty space inside the plasma sail, dropping away from us as we continue to decelerate at 10 centimeters per second squared. It all adds up. In a few minutes, she'll be making nearly 200 kilometers per hour relative to the ships. If they're as monomaniacally thorough as their reputations would have us believe, the cops will take time to finish sterilizing Pygmalion and withdraw their drones before they undock, which will leave them trying to track down a human-sized target tens of kilometers away. And then we'll see. A thought strikes me as I dangle on the rope. I look up at Bill and Ben. How are we going to get back aboard? I ask.
Worry about that later.
They're busy tying the bags to the same anchor point as the rope.
Come on up here.
We've got to get out of sight inside these sacks before they undock. People clinging to the underside of a hatch would be a bit of a giveaway, wouldn't they?
Get in.
And so I spend the next 2 hours hanging upside down from the underside of an airlock, swearing quietly to myself, not crying, scared out of my wits, and periodically peeping through the steam-blinded cameras in hope of picking up some hint, anything at all, really, of what's going on aboard the Pygmalion. The things I do to earn a living. Hello?
Juliet. Can you hear this? Can you hear this?
I'm tired. So very tired. It's good to lie here in this soft, warm bed. But he's talking to me, and I need to do something. I ought to do something. Say something. But it's hard.
Juliet!
I make a monumental effort. Boss?
That's better. We knew you were going to pull through. You've done very well. But maintenance say you went into temporary shutdown. We were very worried for a while, but you're going to be all right. Just a few repairs, of course, but you'll be good as new again in no time. Fit as a fiddle. Isn't that your instrument? Never mind. What one would mean to say is, if there's anything you need, just tell us.
An awful fear floats in the back of my mind, almost out of reach. I try to connect it to my vocalization system. Boss, the sample.
The sample?
Is it... He sounds regretful.
Yes, I'm afraid it is. Which means... The rumors are true, or at least plausible. Whoever broke in last year, we can't count on them not having procured a viable sample of their own. Which means he doesn't know about the other thing. Go back to sleep, Juliet. We can talk about this later.
Footsteps, diminishing.
There'll be time enough for war. Hey, Big Slow, can you hear me?
I come awake slowly.
Bill? No, it's Ben. Listen.
I listen with electrosense and old-fashioned vibratory hearing. There's bumping and banging in the boarding tube above me. Sounds of a hurried retreat. Got it. Any news?
Check your parasite feed.
He flags the view of the corridor heading toward the airlock. It's half-hazed, and a big droplet clings to the middle of the lens, distorting the view, but a quick bit of visual filtering sets me right. The police drones are flying toward the airlock, escorting... Yes, it's Granita. She's talking to them.
Not the one I'm looking for, but one of her sibs. Not my fault the bitch smelled a rat.
She sounds annoyed.
You'll have to do better next time.
The drone is evidently conveying its driver's excuses.
That's not good enough. I've got better things to do than stand guard over your targets all year.
No, I don't suppose it matters. She could have been useful. They get to the airlock vestibule.
Yes, thank you. I need to proceed to my estates as rapidly as possible, unfinished business. If you have a spare seat, I'll take it.
Yes, I'd love to witness your mopping up. If you could record it for me, I'm sure I could find a fitting use for it.
Pour encourager les autres.
She smiles coldly at the drone, then follows it aboard the police cutter. I shudder. Dainty feet kick off overhead, leaving behind the Pygmalion and the rest of her false flag operation. Granita must be working for her, one of my ghost selves warns me. I think I know which one it is, now, and I resolve to trust those instincts in future. A minute later, there's a furious rattling and banging. Then the docking tube detaches. Almost immediately, the police cutter begins to fall away from Pygmalion, sliding past the airlock with the remorseless momentum of a freight train. It barrels down into the blue, soupy sky of plasma and disappears in a flicker of lightning. With its high-thrust drive, it can drop toward Mars and fire up the motor just before arrival, getting there hours ahead of us.
All clear, Big Slow.
I laboriously extract myself from the sack and climb back up to join Bill and Ben on the lip of the airlock. I'm dreading what I'll find on the other side of it.
You can come inside now.
I cycle through the lock into stifling heat and humidity. As I strip off my chainmail, I realize it's over 90 degrees. Spheres of hot water cling to the ceiling, wobbling like improbable steaming jellies before they fall slowly to the floor. One of them breaks off and lands on my shoulder, trickling down inside. It's not physically damaging, but it's painfully hot. Maybe the pink police were trying to poach the passengers. Bill, Ben, what do you think?
Better get back to our stateroom, Big Slow. I don't think we're going to be too popular around here.
I nerve myself. Pygmalion? She replies at once. She sounds distracted.
I'm busy. Go to your room, Catherine.
Told you so. Ben smugs at me. I pretend I didn't hear him. Our stateroom is a tip. It's been thoroughly searched, and there's nothing quite as messy as a room that's been turned over in microgravity. I lock the door behind us and contemplate the wreckage with dismay.
It's only for another day, Bill or Ben reminds me. Chill out and try to ignore it. They didn't find us, did they?
No, agrees Pygmalion, startling me. The decoy worked superbly.
I know that they seem to have taken Ford with them. Do you know anything about that?
No, I think for a moment. I believe she went willingly, though, which implies a degree of collusion.
Quite possibly.
Pygmalion is silent for a while.
I think it would be best if you remain in your room till we arrive, then leave discreetly. The other passengers are highly upset, and some of them may assume that you're a police informer if you reappear.
Has Jeeves offered to pay, then? Bill snipes.
One does not discuss confidential corporate arrangements in public.
Pygmalion's snippy put down is clear enough. 10 to 1, Jeeves has paid handsomely for her to collude in smuggling me past the pink police.
This has been most inconvenient. My upholstery is damaged and my passengers outraged. It's scandalous. But...
oh. Her tone changes.
Oh, no.
What's...
they've just launched a missile.
She pauses for a knife-edged second.
It's running directly away from us. Why would they do that?
More seconds tick by.
It just detonated. 96 kilometers away.
Most strange. I shudder convulsively. It is anything but strange if you are privy to all the facts. A stuffed suit, floating in vacuum, drifting ever farther from Pygmalion's airlock, and an RSA cutter with a frustrated captain and an impatient VIP passenger aboard to witness the kill. Someone really doesn't want my payload to reach Mars. Hors de combat. Welcome to Marsport, Dymas. A brief factual rundown cannot do the place justice. I've been here before, even lived here for a handful of years, but it never fails to surprise. Let me attempt to explain. Dymas is the outer of Mars's two moons, an irregular, rocky lump between 10 and 15 kilometers in diameter, depending on where you hold your measuring calipers. It was originally covered in loose regolith, high in carbon, which has long since been recycled for construction materials. A century of solar energy beamed from the big collectors near Mercury powered the rockets that adjusted its orbit, and today Dymas is the anchor weight for the largest surface-to-orbit space elevator ever constructed. Bifrost. Most of the inner planets have no space elevator at all, Venus and Mercury because their days are unfeasibly long, Earth because its gravity well and debris belts challenge the limits of engineering. But Luna has the L1 lift, and as for Mars... Mars lies on the cusp of the heavily populated, energy-rich inner system and the material-rich outer system. Mars also has Deimos, the perfect construction site and gravitational anchor for Bifrost. And so it was inevitable that Mars, the gateway to the outer solar system, would acquire an elevator like Bifrost and a city like Marsport to run it. Most elevators are simple things. Parallel tapes traversed by sluggish climbers, drudge laborers whose groaning cantilevers bear the burden of interplanetary freight among the worlds of the outer solar system. But there's nothing simple about Bifrost. The complex of cables is 0.5 kilometer across, wide enough to anchor a world. Fast express shuttles hurtle up and down with passengers, while the slow, sturdy supertrain scows take weeks to complete a round trip, lowering refined feedstocks and returning with processed materials, manufactured more conveniently in the turbulent forges of Mars than in orbital facilities, and which can then be exported to the rest of the inner system. 250,000 indentured arbiters and their aristo overseers, and perhaps 1/10 that number of independent souls, work the port facilities, loading and unloading cargo, inspecting payloads, maintaining the infrastructure, untangling problems, and serving those who get the real work done. Once our dead creators ran ports like this, with names like Liverpool and New York and Singapore. Today, as the jester said, everything is automated. Plenty of hands keep the traffic flowing, hour by hour and year by year. Pygmalion is tiny in comparison to Marsport, a fist-sized hovercam buzzing alongside a gigantic freight dirigible. I follow her progress as traffic control directs her final approach to a small peripheral docking hub on the poleward flank of Voltaire Crater. "You will please stay in your cabin while the other passengers debark," she tells me, prissily. "I will notify you when you may leave." I think she's still upset because of the water damage to the saloon ceiling. She's probably as certain I'm smuggling something as that coldly treacherous Aristo Ford. But she stays bought, and Jeeves will pay her well enough. So Bill, Ben, and I wait impatiently until she says, "You may go." Then we leg it through the dripping corridors and out onto the dockside. Arrival on Marsport is not subject to customs. It's a free port, the pink police aside. I still recall my bearings from my last visit over a decade ago. The problem is not so much arriving as being seen to arrive, but I've got a solution for that problem. The Honourable Catherine Sorico emerges from Pygmalion fully an hour after the other passengers have left. She's taken the time to change into a distinctive puffball dress, worn over free-fall pantaloons, ruffled and pleated and patched with metallic lace, with warning lights blinking at ankle and cuff. She doesn't skulk around grimy dockside loading tunnels and container farms, but sweeps along, her servants behind her, and commandeers the first conveyance she claps eyes on, a crew service spider that's clearly seen better days, directing the hapless arbiter to take her to the nearest tube stop. She sits stiffly erect, eyes straight ahead, her servants sitting atop the spider's passenger cage as it scuttles through warrens and alleyways and across debris nets, finally landing just beside the tube hatch. "Summon me a private carriage," she tells one of her servants. "I want to be settled into the Grand Imperial in time to send out calling cards before evening." The servant complies. Only a minute later, the hatch opens. The Honourable Catherine climbs into the padded compact tube ball, directs her arbiters to make their own way to her estate, closes the hatch, and is seen no more. 10 minutes and three private tube balls later, Maria Montes Gua, an independent plumbing contractor, hairless in dark coveralls with specialized optical turrets in place of the bishojo glistening orbs of an aristo, emerges diffidently from a service hatch in a public station, her tool bag strapped across her shoulders. I'm rather proud of Maria. There is little I can do to disguise the build and height of my archetype, but misdirection and a simple mask can work wonders. With luck, any watching arbiters will be scanning for Kate. Her distinctive outfit was carefully chosen to confuse gate recognition monitors, and Maria's facial features to bamboozle eye recognition. It won't work against a determined adversary for long, but it shouldn't need to. I realize I'm being followed as I drift past a waiting room. He's almost my size, large for an indentured arbiter, his face a featureless ovoid, bland and unnoticeable. I check my memory. He's been following me for almost a minute. I feel a frisson of shock and annoyance at my own ineptitude. What should I do? Juliet's reflexes come to the rescue. I keep moving, looking for an unoccupied shrine, one of those curious rooms of repose that our creators installed in all public places. I find the shrine at last. I place my hand on the ideogram, an up-pointing triangle superimposed over the body of a stick figure, and go inside, then switch off the lighting. A few seconds later, the inner door opens behind me. Juliet takes over, just as a tantalizingly familiar voice asks, "Freya?" I pull my blow, bounce off his shoulders, and recoil toward the ceiling. "Ow!" "I don't like the drugs that keep you thin," he says rapidly. "That was most amateurishly done, Freya, but one is grateful for your lack of proficiency on this occasion. Your phrase?" "Ouch!" I spin gracefully into the far wall, trying to center myself again. Down in the park with a friend called Five. That's right, isn't it?
Certainly.
The lights flick on as he finds the switch. It's the faceless Arbiter from the hallway, of course. But the voice is pure Jeeves. I freeze a little, inside. I didn't take him for one who would harbor aristo tendencies. What's the problem? I hear myself ask.
A little trouble with the neighbors.
It's hard to read his voice without any facial cues. It's creepy to hear Jeeves's rich-toned voice coming from the featureless Arbiter body. The RSA are conducting a sweep, and one thought it would be best if none of our associates were caught up in it, so we decided to intercept you before the designated rendezvous. Oops. Alarm bells are clanging in my head. Did you get my message?
What message?
The one I sent yesterday, from the ship. The faceless body freezes still as if its owner is elsewhere. Then,
no, but your late arrival was noted.
What about Bill and Ben? He stays frozen, his head tilted to one side. I can almost see the expression of surprise.
Who?
My two assistants, the ones you gave me. I trail off.
You had assistants? You were supposed to be traveling unaccompanied.
Jeeves sounds displeased.
My dear, one suspects that trouble has followed you from Mercury. Inquiries shall be made.
I'm beginning to be spooked by the non-arrival of my mail, to say nothing of the terrible Twosome's disappearance.
You can say that again.
Can you take the consignment from me here?
Yes.
He reaches up and opens his head. Inside, there's a foam-padded chamber of exactly the right dimensions. He extracts a small wallet from it and passes it to me.
Your delivery fee.
One moment. I sniff the air. It's the traditional 10% oxygen, 90% carbon dioxide mix at 30 Celsius. Within the cargo's survival parameters if I make the transfer quickly. All right. I squat carefully, then simultaneously relax and tense certain motor groups in my lower abdomen. I've almost forgotten there's a foreign object lodged inside me. But now it makes its presence known in a very peculiar, not entirely pleasant way. I reach down hastily and catch the pale brown ovoid before it can drift into a hard surface and sustain damage. Then I place it inside Jeeves's head.